Thanks for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to talk about vehicle maintenance. And Jim Ward is back with us once again. He's a retired vehicle service manager who worked in the industry for 36 years. And we're going to start by talking with him about what to do in these warm weather conditions as we go through summer. Are you having problems with your car, though? Does it sound funny when it starts? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's good to be here.
Let's talk about going on the road. What's the first thing you should be checking on your vehicle when planning that summer road trip?
Well, you want to check your tires. You want to check your fluids. It's important. Depending on what kind of road trip you're doing, whether it's a day trip or a longer trip, it's important always to consider that you might have a breakdown and have emergency supplies, have a fully charged cell phone. In the summertime, it isn't quite as bad. Well, it can be, I guess, is it in the wintertime if you have a breakdown, but it depends on how hot it is. But it's also important, when we think of summer and we think of heat, the reason that we have all that heat is the sun is closer to us here in the northern hemisphere, and the sun really beats on surfaces. And so, whether you're taking a road trip or not, it's important to make sure that the car's finish and the interior are protected because the sun and that UV energy will beat them up pretty badly.
Yeah. I was drove up to Bayfield last Thursday, and then I drove back on Saturday. And I have a screen that shows my miles per gallon gas that I'm getting. And at one point, I was hitting 70, 75 on the interstate, and I'm looking at my gas mileage. And then we had to slow down for a while for one thing or another, and my gas mileage went up about 3 miles per gallon at the slower speed. And I guess probably that's one way to stretch your gas mileage is to slow down a little bit. But what, in your mind, what are the best ways?
Well, that is very true. I mean, the big thing about higher speeds is the wind resistance. That's really what takes your mileage down. You get in the range of 59 to 69 miles an hour. There's a huge increase in how much wind resistance you have. But other factors that you can't, and headwinds and tailwinds can help you a little bit. But something that makes a huge difference is tire pressures. Most modern vehicles have a tire pressure warning light, so we don't worry too much about it, think too much about it until that light comes on. But on most vehicles, that light is triggered to have a threshold to come on when the tire pressure is 7 pounds low. You're probably not in big danger with a tire that's 5 to 7 pounds low. It certainly will handle better and have better traction and braking if the tire pressures are correct, but the car will probably feel fine, but it can make a big difference in your gas mileage. And one other little thing that you really wouldn't notice much of a difference in performance, the car would probably seem to have pretty normal power and acceleration, but if your air filter is pretty dirty, it's going to rob you of gas mileage too. Those are two really easy things to keep on top of. Keep that tire pressure up at the manufacturer setting, which is on a little placard on the driver's door jamb, and either check it yourself or have that air filter checked pretty regularly. And when it's dirty, replace it, because you really won't have a obvious warning to tell you that it's down, but your gas mileage could drop 5 to 10 miles per gallon just because of that air filter.
Wow. What about gas to use on a trip? Is it ever necessary to say use premium gas if the automaker says you don't need it?
Well, certainly, no. If the automaker says you don't need it, you do not need it. There are a few that do require premium gas, but for the most part, that's not true for most vehicles, and there really isn't a time when, if the manufacturer doesn't call for it, there is not a time where you would need to use that.
Which are the most fuel-efficient cars on the road these days?
Well, the plug-in electric, of course, are the most fuel-efficient. It's very interesting. I've read a few different stories that people have written about taking trips across the country in a plug-in electric, and, just, it just the adventure of finding where you're going to be able to charge it up. But clearly that's kind of a special case. So you're not really using gasoline and regular fuel that way. And typically, as a rule, it's going to be smaller, lighter vehicles that tend to get the better mileage.
Yeah. And the hybrids, the hybrids, they do a pretty good job as well, I think.
They do. And, and with any vehicle, when it comes to fuel mileage, your driving techniques can make a big difference, too. We had talked about tires and air filters, but, controlling how hard you accelerate, and there's a technique that, of just sort of the pulse and go, where you kind of get your vehicle up to the speed, kind of coast a little bit. You don't want to do that to the point where the vehicle's you're almost feeling a rock. You're going to make your passenger sick. But there are definitely some techniques. You talked about driving on the trip to Bayfield and back, and having that screen displayed that shows your fuel mileage. For some people, that may not make much difference. But when I have that displayed, I can't help but myself, but, on the 3-second intervals that you look around in the mirror, look at gauges, look at the road, I look at that thing and I do things to try to maximize, my mileage. It helps. It's like a video game or something, like a little reward. And so you can play with that pulse and release acceleration or, driving method. And there are little things you can do. You'd be amazed how much you can affect it just by, being a little gentler and a little easier on acceleration, braking, and the way that you use your engine.
Tom in River Falls has a question for us. So let's go to Tom. Hi, thank you for calling.
All right, well, thank you for having me. My question is I have a 2021 Toyota 4Runner, and I was going to check the transmission fluid, but there's no stick. So how do you know when that transmission, other than looking in your owner's manual, should be replaced or is low? And my second question is, which is better, the normal power steering or the electronic power steering?
Well, in regard to the transmission fluid, it's a sealed transmission. So unless you develop a leak, you're not going to be low on fluid. And the modern transmissions that are electronic sealed transmissions are pretty sensitive. So, I'm not going to say they're going to break down if they're a little bit low, but the shifting will change. It might be a little later, a little harsher. There would be symptoms and signs you'd realize if that fluid got low. But it is not something that you can check yourself. And ultimately, I, off the top of my head, I'm not sure of the interval on 21 4Runner, but it's probably like 120,000 miles before that fluid really needs to be flushed, because it is a modern synthetic fluid, and the way the transmissions are controlled with the computers that control them, that fluid doesn't really get worked as hard, and it doesn't get dirty as quickly. And it being synthetic fluid, it just lasts longer. Then the second question is about steering. Electronic steering's been around for a long time, since before 2000, vehicles had electric power assist steering. And, over that time, in my experience, I've seen fewer problems, number one, just fewer breakdowns and problems with the electronic power steering than with standard power steering systems in terms of leaks and belts and, various things failing on them. One thing that they don't like is, if you in the wintertime slide and bump a curb, that bump can send it can cause the electric motor to get a negative charge and actually damage it. So that's one weakness that probably wouldn't happen with a conventional power steering system compared to the electric. But that is not something I saw happen very often. It's like you don't want to be sliding into curves, and most people do whatever they can to avoid it. But that is one vulnerability that I've seen that they have. But by and large, I think the electronic systems tend to be tighter. They are adaptive for how you drive, like most electronic and computer control systems are, and seem to be so far more dependable.
Tom, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800 604-280-6421234. Give a call or email to talk@WPR.org. Kent emailed us about a 2025 Tucson hybrid. Their AC on their hybrid doesn't reliably work. Sometimes it works. Other times it takes many miles before it kicks in. Wondering what's up with that.
Boy, it sure does not. Yeah, it's not normal operation, the fact that it works. It sounds like it does work well when it works. So it's not going to be low on refrigerant gas because if it was low, it wouldn't work well part of the time and not other times. So it sounds like we have some kind of electronic control issue for it. It's strongly, 2025 is still going to be under warranty. I don't have the answer to what's wrong with it, but I would recommend getting a hold of the dealer and, have them check it out. It's something that is going to be covered to have repaired, and it'd be interesting to know. I don't know off the top of my head, but some kind of electronic control is not working right. You know, a lot of hybrids do have settings, like an eco mode for acceleration that will cut out the air conditioner when you're accelerating, but it shouldn't create the kind of situation is describing there where it just takes a long, long, long time to cool down.
So, Kent, go get it checked out at the dealer, and then the next time Jim's on the show, call back and let us know or send an email and let us know. I think so, too. Chuck in Appleton will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. The reason I'm calling is I have a 2016 F-150, and a couple months ago I had a part replaced in the transmission, and I'm not remembering quite the name, a lead frame. And now the transmission, like from first to second, it's clunky, and then sometimes from five to six, it's clunky. The technician said because it's all computerized, it needs time to reset itself. But now it's been a couple of months. I'm just wondering, are there any suggestions?
Well, within a couple of months, it should have adapted, and that should no longer be the issue. And the fact, I don't know if you just called and talked to them or if they've looked at the vehicle again. A 2016 F-150 is going to be an electronically controlled transmission, and it's going to be real sensitive to the fluid level being just exactly right. The level doesn't have to be so low that it's going to damage anything to start causing symptoms in the shifts. So if they haven't looked at it, they should take a look and check that transmission fluid level, or there may be some other internal control problems in that transmission, but we always hope that it's going to be the easy answer. So I would have them check that fluid level out, and hopefully that's it.
Yeah, good luck, Chuck. Thank you for calling. Julia in Winona, Minnesota, what's on your mind?
I just realized the other day that my horn is not working. I have a 2011 Toyota Corolla, and I was wondering if he has any suggestions about what could be wrong. Do I have to take it to the dealer and maybe estimate on a cost?
Typically, when a horn isn't working, it almost always comes down to the horn itself. I mean, could be a wiring problem, could be a switch problem, but the horn is a component on a vehicle that we don't use very often, and it's got a kind of a metal diaphragm that's got to move, and we live in a state where salt, the horns are right up in front, very exposed. Salt in the wintertime will get in there, and that's not that uncommon a problem. So you probably have a failed horn.
So take it in, and they'll probably put a new horn in then, or what happens?
Right. The horn itself, it's a fairly small device out in the front of the car. The wiring, the switching, everything else for that system is probably fine. But, it could be something else, but the vast majority of the time when a horn doesn't work, it is the horn.
What the heck does it cost to replace a horn? I don't know that's ever come up on this show.
It's typically not a real expensive part. I would think it's going to be somewhere in the range of $25 to $50 for the part.
Oh.
And it's also not super complicated typically to replace. So, the labor is probably going to be $50 or so as well. So, not too bad. Not a horrible expensive repair.
Julia, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jim Ward, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota with the company 36 years and our guest today. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at your automobile today with Jim Ward, a retired service manager. He's been with us for a long time, and it's always great to have him come by. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Just a mention, quick mention, at 12:30, we're going to hear of how some students at UW-Stout are learning to design their own video games. It's pretty cool thing that they're doing at UW-Stout. We'll talk about that at 12:30 today. Right now, we'll hear from Louise in Dodgeville, who has a question perhaps about vehicles. Let's go there. Hi, Louise.
Hi. I was wondering if your guests could comment on new vehicles and standard transmissions. I have a standard transmission right now. Probably will need a new vehicle in a few years. So wondering if those are on their way out, or if they're kind of going to be a niche market. Any predictions?
Oh,
well, they do. They certainly are on the. I don't know if I want to say they're on their way out, like we're never going to see them again. But in terms of popularity, it is more and more difficult to find a manual transmission vehicle that isn't a performance, you know, vehicle.
Yeah.
And there was a time, boy, it just doesn't feel that long ago, that I didn't think I would ever own an automatic transmission vehicle. And I've been driving one for a decade now. And my oldest son, too, he was never going to have a stick, but then he bought a Corolla Hybrid and, you know, he's never looked back. There's a certain pride in having it, and because it's such a niche thing, I mean, one bonus is that it's difficult for people to steal it because a lot of people aren't going to know how to drive it as time goes forward. You know, there's fewer and fewer of them. And unfortunately, I don't have a list to be able to tell you which manufacturers. You know, Volkswagen, I think, still has some. Toyota does in some performance models, but I don't have a list to tell you which vehicles do and don't. But it's going to be a sad day when you just don't see any manual transmission vehicles out there anymore. I'm taking a road trip with some relatives this summer and driving and taking, and this is going to be a stick shift. So it's going to be a good re-education for me on driving a stick.
It's funny. I watch there's a TV show where people are traveling all over in a competition and they go to Europe or someplace where they're suddenly they have to drive a stick shift. And it's pretty hilarious to watch people learn how to drive a stick shift when nobody's really telling them how to do it. That's for sure.
Yeah. It's not intuitive. No.
No, it's not. Oh, man. Suzanne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Suzanne.
I have a 2003 Dodge Caravan. It had very few miles on it when we bought it, like 77,000. So, you know, it was a good van. But now we found out the radiator is overheating, and thus, you know, you can't drive the car. And we found out from the mechanic that somebody put a product called Stop Leak.
Stop Leak?
In the radiator. Yeah. And the mechanic said, they couldn't flush the radiator. So they said the stop leak keeps expanding through the cooling system. And it's very hard to tell where the plug up is from the stop leak that messed up the whole system. And he said that they couldn't flush it out. So he just said to drive it slow and not drive it very far. Do you have any experience with that or any suggestions?
Well, you know, it sounds like you've had the vehicle for a while, right? I mean, it was 77,000 when you got it, and how many miles are on it now?
Oh, maybe 110. We've only had it 3 years. We had it 3 years.
And in that time, you don't know of anyone having put stop leak in it in that time, is that right?
No. No, none of us.
It's interesting because Stop Leak is a product that if you, you know, you really, it's a, it's something I don't really recommend. Whatever is wrong with the cooling system, it's usually if there's a leak in a hose or in the radiator, that leak really should be fixed. But in an emergency, you know, that product can work. One of the keys, if you're ever going to use that product, is that you want to put it in a warm engine, and then you want that engine to be run for as long as possible, an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours, once it's put in, so it circulates and seals properly. The result of not using it properly is that it can get in some of the smaller orifices, like your heater core in the dash, and plug up and cause the cooling system not to be able to circulate. But for if you've had the vehicle that long, put that many miles on it, you never had stop leak put in it, then it doesn't make sense to me, because the stop leak problem would have occurred pretty much right after it was put in. It wouldn't be that it was put in over 3 years ago and now it's causing a problem. So something doesn't make sense there. And if you can't flush the cooling system, you start taking things apart to find out where, you know, will water flow through the radiator itself? Will, you know, checking, you know, parts of it at a time to see if you have flow through them to determine where the blockage is. So, you know, I wouldn't say, no, just continue to drive it and drive it slow, because, you know, if we get hotter and hotter weather, you're going to have to go slower and slower, and pretty soon you're not going to be able to drive at all. So you need to get to the bottom of it. You know, I don't know, you know, how experienced that shop is with dealing with cooling systems and that kind of a problem, but there is a, you know, basically there's a diagnostic step-by-step to get to the bottom of what your cooling system problem is, and somebody needs to follow it. And I don't think they're on the right track when they're telling you that stop leak is a problem when it, you know, hasn't been put in there for over 3 years. So something else is going on there.
Might need to check with a different shop.
Maybe, you know, yeah, or you know, or either that, or there's some procedures that they may recommend that are more expensive, and it's not going to be at no cost. You know, it does cost something to go through and do that kind of diagnosis, as opposed to, you know, making a guess and trying something. But that's what needs to be done to get to the bottom of it.
Suzanne, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And, you know, Dennis emailed maybe with a kind of a related question. He's heard AC systems should be run frequently to maintain performance. In cold weather, do AC systems activate? How would you know if they activate in cold weather?
On almost every vehicle, the AC system automatically activates every single time you put it on defrost. That is how it defrosts. The AC system takes the moisture out of the air, and air conditioners work more by taking moisture out of the air than they do by actually cooling the air. They'll cool it as well, but in the winter, obviously, you have the heat on, and that heat overcomes the cooling of the air conditioning, and the air conditioner's main purpose and function in the winter on defrost mode is to dehumidify, to dry that air out and get the moisture out of the air so that your windows aren't fogged up. So, and it is true that, you know, it's a system that you should turn on a regular basis, you know, so that there's oil in it that needs to circulate through and get to the various components and lubricate them and keep everything working properly. But, yeah, they operate all through the wintertime. And, you know, most people probably use their air conditioning more in the winter than they do in the summer.
Okay. Kyle in Winneconne. That's something I didn't know. Kyle in Winneconne, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I got a 2013 Honda Accord. I got about 279,000 miles on it. I got it serviced recently, some new tires, alignments, brakes, and stuff like that. And after that, I mean, the car's running fine. But, like, my tire pressure light constantly comes on, my power steering comes on, my traction control comes on, my front collision warning, my lane detection warning. And when I'm doing 45, I get a weird rumble in the back.
Lots of dashboard lights going, and then a rumble at around 45 miles per hour.
Well, when you first said the tire light, I suspect it sounds like you've got new tires, and you know, that it may be that the tire pressure sensors have to be registered to the computer. But with all the other warning lights coming on, something is not right here. You know, so with the lights that are coming on, if this work was all done in one shop, I would go back, let them know what happened. It should not be a big deal for them to check for codes. If all those warning lights are coming on, there's some codes that are talking about what's going on. You know, it may be that they service the battery and don't have the ground terminal on tight enough, and that could cause some quirky kind of things, although it wouldn't cause the rumble at 45 miles an hour. When you say that you've got a rumble at that speed, you've got new tires and new brakes, I would have them looking those over. It's possible to have a brand new tire that's that's out of round or has an issue that causes or just as noisy. I've seen a brand new car that was so noisy we thought the transmission was out and turned out to be tires as we went through the diagnostic and process of elimination to get to the bottom of it. You mentioned you got new brakes as well, and it may be that a brake component is doing something that that could be making some noise, but when you have a noise at specific speeds, noises or vibrations, that's usually a tire-related thing. So I would take it back and have them check those tires.
Yeah. Kyle, there you go. Thank you so much. Tim in Kalamazoo, Michigan emailed, he has a 2011 Ford Ranger. When he replaced his battery, he lived in Florida, and they asked him if he wanted a southern battery or a northern battery. Tim learned southern batteries have a thicker shell to protect against the heat, and northern batteries have higher cranking amps for colder temperatures. Since he was moving back up north, he selected a northern battery and noticed that the batteries don't seem to last as long as he remembers. Seems like only about 2 to 3 years. He remembers them going for at least 5 years or more. Is it due to the increased in temperatures and longer delays with higher temps up north taking a toll on the thinner walled northern batteries? Or well, are they not making things like they used to?
Here's the thing. Batteries, generally speaking, are lasting longer than they ever did. That being said, you know, a typical battery life is 3 to 5 years, but we would see batteries that would last, you know, 12 to 15 years. They shouldn't, but some do. We would see batteries that fail in 6 months. They shouldn't, but some do. It's a bell-shaped curve. You know, very few of them at the beginning fail that early. Very few of them last that long. In terms of climate and heat, it is much harder on batteries in a hot southern climate. If you look at battery performance and battery life in the southern third of the United States, batteries fail at a much higher rate than they do in the northern climate, and that's why they have different styles of batteries. Although, you know, that isn't going to make that much difference. You're still going to have a higher rate when it's hotter, and as the climate becomes warmer, we're going to be seeing more and more of that kind of battery failure, you know, at higher latitudes. So that's the story of it, is that, yeah, batteries have a harder time, and they are more affected and fail earlier from heat.
Aaron in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Larry. Just a quick question. I have a 2010 Subaru Outback with 130,000 miles on it, and people have been telling me that the head gaskets blow at a certain mileage, and I was just wondering if this is true or false.
Well, Subaru did have head gasket issues on the Outback model. That the majority of Outbacks did not have head gasket failures. It is just something that is a somewhat higher failure rate than other vehicles. I can't tell you a mileage that something like that would occur at, but the higher the mileage on an engine that has an issue that is a, you know, slightly higher percentage than some other models, the higher the mileage, the greater the chance something like that could happen. You know, but again, the majority of Outbacks didn't have that problem. You know, there's no guarantee that yours is going to have that problem. But in most cases, if it's an external oil leak, head gasket failure can exhibit itself in a lot of different ways. You know, you can leak oil or antifreeze externally or internally into the combustion chamber. But on the Subaru Outback, most of the time it was an external oil leak, which is, if you're going to have a head gasket leak, that's probably the one that's going to cause the least problems, the least likely to cause some engine damage or other issues. But it's just something that you're going to have to keep an eye on.
Aaron, thanks again for calling. Shurina in Hudson, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
So I have a 2014 Jetta VW, and I'm looking for a quiet place. I have squeaky tires. Some of them, I can't tell which ones, but very high-pitched squeak, almost sounds like a siren. And then when I stop the car, sometimes there's a groan, a big old groan, like it's tired, like my engine is tired.
And I'm sorry, I heard what your model of vehicle was, but I didn't understand. I didn't quite get what's the first symptom that you described.
Something about a tire. You wanted to mention that again? The tire makes a whining noise.
A high pitched wheel. And then when I come to a stop sign, it doesn't. So I know it's involved with the brake. because I put on the brakes, and the high-pitched siren-y squeal sound stopped. And then after I drive for a while, the whole thing, it just does, it stops. It never does it again for a while. And then maybe it'll start it up again later.
The fact that it stops when you touch the brakes tells me it's a very great likelihood that it is something related to the brakes. And it may not be some major problem. The Jetta, a lot of cars have a little device on the brake pad, the brake lining, that the brake lining eventually wears out, but they have a little metal device on it that down near the point where you should know that it's starting to get worn will start to make a squeaking sound. And those, it can get out of position. Sometimes they'll make the squeak when they shouldn't. But you know, I do suspect the brakes need to be looked at to find out there's something that is not in the right position. And when you hit the brake and it stops, that's, you know, it's just kind of pushing it back into a position where it's not going to contact. But so there's that. And then you hear a big groaning sound. You know, that could be, I'm not sure. I almost have to experience a drive with you to understand that second sound better. But you know, it's very possible these are all related to the brakes. So I would really strongly recommend get into a shop, take someone for a ride, show them the sounds that you're talking about, and they're going to need to take a look at the brakes and see what's going on there.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Lee in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Lee.
Yeah. Hi there. I have a 2006 Volkswagen Beetle TDI diesel with an automatic transmission. I have two questions. I like to coast a lot. You were talking about, you know, improving fuel economy.
Mm-hmm.
I like to go into neutral a lot when I know my road, where I know where I'm going to turn in, and, you know, I'll just put it in neutral. It would be detrimental in the long run going in and out of neutral and drive. And why don't I have a dipstick? I don't know if you're familiar with the Beetles or the Volkswagen. Why don't I have a dipstick to check my automatic transmission? There's nothing.
Well, sure. Yeah. More and more manufacturers, you know, so Volkswagen have gone to sealed transmission. They're using, there's a number of different reasons for that. But they're using synthetic transmission fluids. And, you know, when it comes to, for example, your engine oil, technically you should use the right kind of oil, but in a pinch, you could put just about any kind of engine oil in there, synthetic, non-synthetic, a lighter weight, a heavier weight. It's just better to have some oil in there than nothing. That is not true at all with a transmission. You do not want to put the wrong fluid into the transmission. That can cause some significant major damage, and the fluids are not always compatible with other fluids. And so that's one of the main reasons that manufacturers went to sealed transmissions, so that you cannot accidentally put the wrong stuff in, topping it up, because the consequences would be pretty detrimental. In terms of your first question, shifting to neutral, trying to get that gas mileage, you know, you're, it isn't real likely anything in the transmission internally is really going to get worn out. There's a detent for your shifter that, depending on how much you do, that detent is, you know, that going in and out of park or in and out of neutral, excuse me, is that eventually could wear out. But again, I don't see that. I just don't picture you constantly doing this, so I don't think you're going to wear that out too quickly either. But that would be about the only concern I have, is something that would wear out, and that's not inside the transmission. Generally speaking, it's more up by the shifter, so it's, even if that did fail, it's not like a transmission failure and a huge expense in repair.
Lee, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Tom in Madison called with a comment about the horn problem earlier that the caller had. He says the caller with the horn problem should check the fuse before bringing it into a repair person.
Not a bad idea. I mean,
he's probably usually had that same issue himself.
Perhaps. You know, fuse is generally in an electrical system of a vehicle, there's not a fuse for every component. So the horn is not likely to have its own fuse that nothing else is on. So if a fuse is blown, generally you have more than one thing that doesn't work, although it's certainly not a bad idea to check the fuse. It could be a fairly easy replacement. You know, I would not expect that if I didn't work on my own vehicles and I took it to a shop and they looked at it and found a blown fuse, that I'm going to have much of an expense. You know, if the horn doesn't work, they generally quickly check for power there. If there's power there, and it's not working, it's a bad horn. If there's no power there, then the fuse is the first thing you're going to suspect. So that would be something that mechanic's going to come on to pretty quickly. So, whether you check it yourself or take it to a shop to have it checked, it, you know, or fuse a failed fuse is not going to end up being an expensive undertaking.
Ross from Bayfield sent us a note. His Audi dealer wants to clean the air intake valves on his 2021 Q7 Audi. It has 45,000 miles on it. Runs fine. Ross uses 93-octane gas and drives mostly highway miles. And the Audi person wants $340 for this B&G chemical cleaning. From what Ross has read, it's not necessary to do. And wonders about your opinion.
I would agree. I don't think it's necessary to do. It's a preventative step to try to keep deposits from building up on the backside of the valves, which can happen over time. You know, there could be an appropriate circumstance in which to do this, but if you did not have drivability problems, if you didn't have problems with your engine running that you took it in for, that they specifically found deposits on, then I would certainly not do that as a preventative step. There's detergent, most of the fuel we use, that keeps the fuel systems pretty clean anymore. And, you know, you probably heard me talk before about various fuel additives. I you know, there's tons of them out there. A lot of them may not be very good, but one in particular is called Seafoam, S-E-A-F-O-A-M. And, you know, using Seafoam in your gas tank, you know, a couple times a year is a good way. It also cleans that same system and, you know, can clean minor deposits off of valves and things. But no, I don't think that service is necessary. Unfortunately, I think it's one that's over-recommended increasingly. But, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Christy in Chippewa Falls has a question. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thank you. The question is, so we have two Subaru, a Forester in Wisconsin, an Outback in Arizona, and each are driven only seasonally and stored other times. How do we maintain that, and what's a good resource, maybe a website, for future questions?
Yeah, thanks. Vehicle that's not driven year-round, or vehicles in this case.
Well, you know, there are some specific things that you want to be aware of and do in those instances. One of the things is battery care. You know, if the vehicle is stored somewhere when it's not being used that has power, a smart battery charger, a battery tender, they tend to be called, is something that you'd want to have on it to make sure that the battery is getting a charge when it needs it. Vehicles that don't get a lot of miles on them still need maintenance. They still should have an oil change at least once a year to get condensation out, particularly the one in Wisconsin and Arizona. Things are a bit drier and may not get as much of that kind of condensation buildup. But the maintenance schedule for any vehicle, a Subaru Forester and a Subaru Outback, will have intervals for both time and mileage for all of the various services. So the oil change may say it's due every, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 miles. It's going to be 6 to 12 months. You know, they're going to have a time interval as well. So, you know, I would just recommend looking at your maintenance manual for that car. It will be spelled out in there what the time intervals are. And you could stretch those a little longer on a low-use vehicle, but still, that's the best guideline on what you should do. You know, and in terms of future questions, and there's so much information and so many things that where you can ask questions on the net. There isn't one in particular, you know, that I can recommend. It depends on the problem. You know, you're pretty safe if you're just asking basic maintenance problems, but if you're trying to get to the bottom of a diagnosis, I don't know if I would be using the internet and websites to do that kind of thing.
Jim Ward, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota and with the company 36 years, and our guest today has been with us for a long time now, and he does a great job. Questions for him? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. And we got open lines to get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Just a quick mention, tomorrow on Garden Talk, Patty Nagai is back to answer all your plant questions, and we'll also talk about the most efficient ways to water. Right now, we're looking at your automobile with Jim Ward, Retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, been with the company 36 years, and he certainly knows a lot about vehicles. Lines are filling up here, so let's go to Tom in Green Bay next. Tom, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to call and say how much I enjoy the show, because I miss Click and Clack, and I view this show with Jim on. It's like a game. People call in with their problems, and I try to see if I can get it before Jim does. So far today, I've only missed one, and that's the air conditioner.
It is. Yeah. What is Click and Clack call? It's Dump the Chump. Yeah. Love that show.
Oh, yeah. Tom, thank you for calling. And you're right about Jim. He's pretty darn good. Raina in Madison, your turn. Hi, Raina.
Hi. So I recently got my oil changed, and the tech was really shocked because I had no oil left in my tank. And he thought that with the interval of miles, having no oil didn't really make any sense. So his suggestion to me was to kind of like let my car sort of idle before when I turn it on and kind of let it like sit on before I take off and go anywhere. But I realized he didn't say for how long, and I was wondering if that is the best option or, yeah, I'd love to know your thoughts.
Sure. What year and model is your car, Raina?
So I have a 2017 Hyundai Santa Fe Sport.
And how long had it been since oil had been changed? You know about how many miles it had been since the previous oil change?
I think it had been about like 3,000.
Okay, that's not a lot of miles.
No.
Well, here is the thing. Your car would be leaking massive amounts of oil to lose that oil through a leak. So you would be seeing oil puddles everywhere if that were the case. You'd probably smell it as well. So I don't think it's burning the oil. The other possibility, leaking the oil. The other possibility could be burning the oil, and modern vehicles can burn a lot of oil and not create smoke out the exhaust like they used to years and years ago. So you may have some condition where your engine's burning oil, or it's also possible that the previous oil change, that they really just didn't fill it or short filled it. That can happen. It obviously should never happen, but it can. At this point, going forward, what we need to do is establish a rate of consumption. A car that uses oil probably has leaking valve seals internally or that's burning oil, or piston rings, but that doesn't necessarily mean you have to take it apart and do a repair. What you have to do is get on top of what rate of oil consumption does it have. So I would, if you don't know how to read it, if you know how to read the dipstick, great, that's the starting point. If you don't, you want to have someone show you, maybe the mechanic that did the oil change, show you how to read the dipstick, show you that it's full and where that is. And I'm going to recommend that you check that dipstick every time you get gas, every time that you fill up, or every few hundred miles at least, that you should check that dipstick. And when it gets one quart, and record what the mileage is at the start, and when that dipstick gets to the point where it's one quart low, we now know what the rate of consumption is. And if that rate of consumption is over a quart to 1,000 miles, it's going to become a problem with deposits building up in the engine. If the rate of consumption is less than that, then you may be able to get by buying oil and adding oil in between oil change intervals. But that's the procedure you need to do now, is learn how to check the oil and establish what the rate of oil use is. If you find that there's no oil being used, then that supports the idea that it wasn't filled properly the last time the oil was changed. But if you find that the oil level does go down, and you're not seeing puddles everywhere, then that means the engine's burning it, and that, that means you're either going to need to do an engine repair or you're going to need to keep a quart of oil in the car and add it when it gets a quart low.
Raina, there you go. I was thinking about my own experience when you were talking. I had bought a brand new car. I took it up north from the dealership practically. I was acting funny. I stopped at the dealer in Hayward, and he couldn't figure it out. He called Madison, the Madison shop, and this was a Chevy dealer. And they said, oh, you better bring it back. It was a brand new car. And they said, have some oil, quarts of oil. So I had four quarts of oil in addition to the full oil, and I used all four quarts in 300 miles. And it turns out when the engine was made, they forgot to put the O-rings on one side of the pistons.
Wow. Yeah, that would go through some oil. That would go through some oil. Yeah.
Oh, man. So I got a new engine out of it, is what happened there, I think. Oh, man. Let's see. Where are we going here? Robert in Madison. We'll go to you. Hi, Robert.
Okay, well, don't want to beat a dead horse on oil, but I guess oil's pretty important. So, all right. So I'm used to having a side three that burns oil, so I was, you know, adding it and changing it all the time. Now I've got a fancy Volvo XC 2022 XC60. And recommendations seem all over the place. I'm not sure exactly what's in the owner's manual. You don't seem to get an owner's manual anymore. I guess it's online or on the car's computer or something. I don't know, but I haven't bothered to look for it. But, you know, other people that have these say, oh, I just get my oil changed once a year. Okay. And then, you know, other folks or the dealer, but I'm not even sure what the dealer says, but they charge $200 for an oil change. I know that much. But just a mechanic says, oh, I wouldn't pay any attention to that. You know, what the owner's manual says or what the dealer says or what anybody else says, I would just get a change every 5,000 miles no matter what. Okay, so... You know, with synthetic oil, I mean, in a new car, I mean, is that crazy once a year, or does that have to be 5,000, you know?
Well, it isn't necessarily, but here's the thing. The manufacturer does have an interval that they recommend, and it's going to have both a time and a mileage interval, and it should be by whichever occurs first. For some people, that might be a year. And I don't know off the top of my head what it is. Most manufacturers, I have, you know, the vast majority of them have intervals that are 6 months and 5,000 miles or 12 months and 10,000 miles. There are some outside of that range, but that covers probably 90, 95% of the cars that are out there for what's recommended. A $200 oil change is an expensive oil change. You could probably get it done less expensive, but it's still very, very cheap compared to engine work that might have to get done if you don't change your oil frequently enough. So I would go to the manufacturer's website if you don't have an owner's manual, find out what they recommend for the oil change interval, and that's what I would do. That's, it's the most basic maintenance on the car, and it's much, much cheaper than engine repairs.
Yeah, it is indeed. Robert, thanks for calling. Jim near Marshall, do you have a quick comment?
In 1999, my wife and I bought a Ford Expedition. 17 years ago, she retired as an educator. It became a garage queen. It has 67,000 miles on it, and it's not driven in the winter, so the body's in excellent shape. It was a battery tender that kept that Motorcraft battery in that vehicle for 21 years, and I'm proud to drive it because in 1999, this looks exactly like the Wisconsin State Patrol vehicle I had. And tell you what, talk radio at its finest, and keep up the good work. Thank you very much.
Oh, great story. Great story. I love it. 21 years. I got to write that down because that might be a new record that I've heard.
Wow. Oh, that is that's absolutely wonderful. Well, Frank emailed us. He's wondering about CBT transmissions and how they compare to the older automatic transmission. Also, how often should the fluids be flushed? Can you answer that in about 40 seconds, Jim?
Well, it's a CVT is a constant variable transmission. It's a little bit simpler setup, really, than the conventional automatic transmission. They work very well. That's why many manufacturers are going to them. And, you know, I'm sorry, I don't remember the second part of the question.
Oh, how often should the fluids be flushed?
Oh, manufacturer recommendation. It's always, when it comes to fluid changes, you know, you're going to find that some places are going to recommend more frequently, but, you know, you really find out what the manufacturer recommends for your year and make vehicle. That's what it should be.
Jim Ward, our guest, he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. Retired. He was worked in the industry for 36 years or over 36 years. It's always great to have him with us, and he'll be back to answer your questions right after this look at the news. You stay with us. Great to have you with us on WPR News, talking with Jim Ward about vehicle maintenance. Jim's worked in the industry for over 36 years, and great to have him back. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. Our lines are all filled right now. You could email us to talk@WPR.org or try 800-642-1234. And let's go right to the phones again and to Ann in Middleton. Ann, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question is, I'm hoping you can put reassure me on something. I share my vehicle with someone who drives using cruise control all the time, even in the city. And I have two concerns. One is, you know, is that damaging to the car in any way to use cruise control for, you know, city driving? And then part two is, when I get in the vehicle, then the cruise is left on and not engaged, but, you know, just the light shows up. And I don't know, if I don't notice it and turn it off right away, does that cause any damage? Thanks.
Sure, and none of that causes any damage. It is fine to use the cruise control in town. The cruise control being on and not engaged is not going to cause any problems for it either. You know, cruise control, the one caveat it is, and this is, you're not the one using it this way, but cruise control can be a little dangerous if you're using it in heavier traffic situations, which is often in-town situations. You know, you've really got to be ready to be on the brake and cancel that cruise control. But that being said, that doesn't mean someone can't become quite adept at doing that. It's just you need to be much more aware and be ready to take off that acceleration in an emergency. None of that is causing any harm to anything on the car.
There you go, Ann. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Patricia in Amigo, your turn. Hi, Patricia.
Hello. I have a 2016 Ford C-Max hybrid, and I've read that the batteries, you know, the hybrid batteries wear out and have to be replaced at around 100,000 miles. I've got 130,000 miles on mine, so I'm wondering if I have a battery replacement in my future. And, yeah, I really enjoyed the show.
You know, the batteries do eventually fail, but, you know, I don't know. I'm not an expert on that particular make and model to know if they've had any particular issues, but for the most part, you know, these will last as long as we used to expect engines and transmissions to last. 200 to 300,000 miles is not uncommon at all. So, you know, I wouldn't say at 130,000 miles that you have an imminent battery failure. You know, there's no particular preventative thing you can do, and there's no test that's going, you know, unlike the conventional battery, there's no test that's going to tell. There's a warning light that'll come on if that battery starts to experience failures. The batteries are, the hybrid batteries are made up of a number of separate cells. Those cells have to be able to be charged within a certain tolerance of one another, and the most common failure is when one of them starts to drop out and they just cannot keep that within that tolerance anymore, and that's going to be a failed battery. But it's not common, and you know, I would think that you probably have 50 to 70,000 miles of driving before you're really going to have to start worrying and thinking about that.
There you go, Patricia. Thank you for calling. Michael in Mequon. We'll go to you now. Hi, Michael.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. I have a 2010 Toyota Highlander, the model with the four-cylinder engine, and it's got about 170,000 miles on it right now. It gets all of the recommended maintenance. It drives mostly city local driving and once a month maybe a 600-mile trip. I was wondering if you could give me any idea of what the range of the lifespan of that vehicle might be.
Yeah, the Highlander is a vehicle that's done very well. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see that engine get 250 to 300,000 miles.
Yeah, I've got a Highlander. I like it a lot. And I think I only have about 125,000 on mine. But I'm expecting to keep it for a long time.
Yep. Well, and following that maintenance schedule is a big part of it. But, yeah, I mean, that's a good vehicle, good performer, and the engines do last a long time.
Michael, thanks. Let's go to Jake in Solon Springs. Hi, Jake.
Hi. I got a question. I got a 2015 LML Duramax. I do all the recommended maintenance on it. I'm doing oil changes every 10,000 miles with full synthetic, draining the tranny fluid and the external filter swap on it every 50,000, rear end every 50,000. Is there any other maintenance that I should be doing on this? The only thing that scares me is a CP4 pump, fuel pump on these, and I was wondering, is it a really massive thing to worry about, or is it more hyped up than what it is?
Well, you know, if, in terms of the fuel pumps, if yours has that problem, it's kind of a massive and expensive problem to fix. You know, but it's not all of them have that kind of an issue. You know, it sounds like you're primarily concerned about drivetrain fluids. You were talking about transmission fluid and the differentials. If it's four-wheel drive, you don't want to forget the transfer case either. And if we're, you know, talking just all general vehicle fluids, and the antifreeze should be changed at the manufacturer interval on that vehicle as well. You know, and how many miles are on it now?
I bought it in September of 44. There's 150,000 on it now. I use it for hot shotting, so it's on the road a lot.
Yep. I would continue to follow that maintenance interval. There's really nothing, I don't think there's anything you can do to prevent the potential of a fuel pump failure, but, 150,000 miles, it sounds like you're doing the right things.
Yeah, there you go, Jake. Thank you. Joe in Lac-des-Flambeaux, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I've got a 2017 Toyota Tacoma with a 2.7 four-cylinder and a five-speed. I'm just wondering, you know, when I'm driving like at 60, normally I shift up at about 3,000 RPMs and then downshift around 2. But when I'm driving at about, you know, I normally don't upshift on highway speeds until up to fifth gear until about 70 miles per hour. But if I'm driving like at 65, is it more efficient to be in fourth gear where the RPMs are closer to 3, or in fifth gear where they drop down closer to 2?
Well, the lower RPM, as long as the engine's not lugging, is your goal. That's where you're going to get your best mileage, assuming you're not towing anything. Towing can kind of change, you know, the whole equation here. But just for standard driving, you know, I would be shifting into fifth by the time I got up to anywhere, any highway speed, 55 miles an hour and above. And, you know, that lower RPM is going to give you better fuel mileage.
All right. There you go, Joe. Thank you. Eric in Columbus, Ohio, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hey, enjoying the program a lot. Have a 2011 Chevy Tahoe, 173,000 miles. It spent the winter in a garage up in northern Michigan and with a battery tender. And I noticed when I go to start the vehicle after an overnight, it'll crank and crank and crank before it starts. Once I've driven it, it just cranks a little bit like normal. It'll start right up. But again, if it sits a couple hours, you'll hear the starter spin for quite a while before it starts.
Sure.
Do I have a bad solenoid? Do I have a bad relay? How would you check?
Well, when you say you hear the solenoid, so I assume when you turn the key, it's turning the engine over. It's going rah, 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 like that, not just some.
Yes.
Buzzing, right? So it's not the starter problem. The starter's turning the engine. Usually what you're describing is a loss of fuel pressure. The fuel pressure, the fuel system on that vehicle is a pressurized fuel system, so there's supposed to be pressure right up to the injectors, and if there's a leak somewhere in that system and it leaks down, then the symptom you're going to get is long cranking times on a cold start. When you come back to start it warmer, it hasn't leaked down the pressure yet, and so it doesn't exhibit the symptom when the engine's warmer. That's what needs to be checked. Is it, you know, it could be is something like a fuel pump check valve, but somewhere I would believe you're losing fuel pressure.
All right, Eric. Check it out. Thanks for calling. Marsha in Verona. We'll go to you now. Hi, Marsha.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a 2015 Tuber Forester, and the last few times when I've gotten the oil check, the next morning after the car has sat all night, I will check the oil level just because I'm paranoid. But anyway, it's always above that top little hole. You know, there's the bottom one, and then there's the top one. And it's always higher than that. And I always thought it was supposed to be in between those two. But the when I called and asked, they said that that's where they want it when the car is at rest, because when you start the engine up, the car takes in the oil, and then it's at the right level.
Well, the right level is when the engine's off and the vehicle has sat for, well, you know, if it sat at least 15, 20 minutes, but certainly if it sat overnight, that's going to be when you're going to get the correct reading. And the two lines on the stick, one of them is full, and then the lower one is one quart low. Now, they may have overfilled it a little bit, and that's not that big a deal. It isn't. You know, most modern engines are designed to be safely operated in a range of anywhere from up to one quart over full to one quart low. I'm not going to recommend that you do that on purpose, but it, you know, it sounds like yours is just a little bit over, so that really is a harmless thing, but the correct reading is taken with a cold engine with the engine off.
All right, Marsha, there you go. Thank you for calling. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Email to talk at WPR.org. Rich called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering about variable transmission. He's got a new 2013 Nissan Sentra, has a variable transmission. What's the life expectancy of this type of transmission? I think we did kind of address that, maybe.
We did, and you know, I mean, the evidence so far is that they will last as long as in the conventional transmissions, you know, 200,000 to 300,000 miles or more.
Teresa in Waterloo emailed. She has a 2022 Buick Enclave Avener with only 18,000 miles on it. Her issue is the infotainment and dashboard lighting. The lighting adjustment doesn't work. It on its own goes to the brightest setting, which is extremely bright and distracting at night. And then Teresa can't adjust it down. She took it to the dealer, and they thought they had fixed the issue, but it has started doing the same thing again. Any thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure what, you know, it'd be interesting to know what they did to try to fix it. But it doesn't sound like they've gotten to the bottom of it. I don't know if this is this could be some kind of a software control issue where they tried to update something, didn't get it right, or we may have some components failing. But yeah, I think I would get back to that shop and have them recheck their work.
Catherine, Catherine emailed us. She has a 2010 Toyota Prius hybrid, lives in Marshfield. In the winter, she'll go weeks during which she drives four or fewer miles at a time. Many days, she'll drive several short distances running errands. Would it be a good idea to use a battery tender? Her 12-volt battery died suddenly a year or two ago. Would her driving habits have contributed to that?
It's possible that, you know, if the car's driven every day, but it's driven such a short mileage, you probably are over time, you know, taking more out of the battery than you're putting back into it. When you start the car out, you're taking a withdrawal out of an account. You could think of it like a piggy bank, and when you drive the car, you put that back in. But if you're driving very short distances, you're probably not quite getting enough back in there. So that is going to likely shorten the life of the battery. And if you possibly can, you'd be doing yourself a big favor to once a week take that car out and get on the highway and drive it, you know, 20, 25 minutes, and that really should replace, that should recharge your battery enough to make up for all of the short trips the rest of the week.
Kathleen in Milwaukee, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kathleen.
Well, hello. I'm just calling with a question about recommendations for products and processes to remove dried-on insects from a long road trip. I have a 2010 Toyota Prius with 110,000 miles on it, but I had some body work done a couple of years ago after a deer hit us, and so the front portion was repaired, and so I don't know the quality of the paint on there and what I need to do to you know, maintain good looking
yeah.
quality.
Sure, sure. Well, let's talk about bugs and tar to start with. There are products that are specifically called bug and tar remover. They've got a combination of solvents and just the right amount of abrasive to be able to aggressively come after those things. That being said, the best thing you can do is to do that cleaning frequently or you know, very quickly after, you know, if you've driven to do some construction work or where they've recently seal coated a highway or, you know, on a particularly buggy trip where a lot of bugs got on there, the longer that stuff sits and sunbakes on there, the harder it is going to be to get off. But again, specific product bug and tar remover will be your best bet for getting those things off. Beyond that, you know, the best way to protect that paint is that once you do have it completely clean, you know, the old Carbana wax is the hardest. You know, there are spray-on waxes. There are car washes. They'll do a quick kind of wax coating that they can put on when your car is being washed. That's going to come off and wear off the quickest. There are spray waxes that you can put on yourself. But the old-fashioned Carbana wax that you have to wax on, wax off, basically, is really what is going to look the best and protect that paint the best.
Kathleen, thank you very much for calling. Linda in Marshfield. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hello, I'm wondering what you think of the dealership kind of pushing for an extended warranty for another $1,000 or $2,000?
Well, extended warranties can be a good thing. You know, it's funny, I because I tend to build my own things and fix my own things, I've kind of been averse to those, but at the same time, you know, my kids are not necessarily that way, so they tend to take those policies out, and they've saved them a few times when I wasn't available to help out. So, I mean, they're not necessarily a bad thing. They can get more expensive. You may want to shop around to find out what's available, and I would also, one of the most important things is find out what the actual name of that extended warranty is, and if you think you're going to be going anywhere else for service, I would call that other shop and find out if that's something they honor and what they think of that particular brand, because some of those are more fly-by-night, some of those service contracts that really don't cover a lot. They cost a lot up front. They don't cover a lot. And other ones are actually pretty decent, you know. So like any kind of, it's an insurance product, basically, like any of them, you need to do some investigating and find out what kind of things they cover, what kind of things they don't. And I would find out what the actual name brand of the service policy is and call around to some shops and ask them if they've heard of it, what they think of it. You know, if they tell you, oh, it's a great one, it works, you know, then that's good news. If they tell you, I've never heard of it, or if they tell you, you know, this is a fly-by-night operation, just trying to take your money, well, you know,
you know what to do.
So there's a whole variety of them out there. So you need to find out a little bit more about that particular one to find out whether it's a good investment for you.
All right, Linda, thank you. Jerry in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, hi. Yes, I have a 2012 Malibu, and the fobs on the key don't unlock and lock the doors anymore. And both of them are the same way. And it's just dead. For a while, I could walk around the car holding the buttons down, but once in a while, the trunk lid would open up. And now none of it works.
Okay.
But I can lock them in the inside of the car.
Well, Jerry, there's a battery inside that remote, and those batteries may only last 3 years. So, you know, you could go to a dealer, or you could even go to, like, a Batteries Plus. They have a little tester that'll tell whether that's giving off the radio frequency that it should be giving off or not. And if it's not giving anything off, then they're tending to try a battery first and then retest it and make sure it works. But in all likelihood, it's just a battery replacement that they need.
There you go, Jerry. Thank you for calling. David emailed us. He started using synthetic oil in his 2014 Subaru Outback with 165,000 miles. Is it worth it using synthetic oil in older vehicles, or is it no better than conventional?
There are engines that are designed specifically to use synthetic oil. Yeah, we had another call, and we were talking about oil. You know, in a pinch, you're better off to have either one of those oils at any weight oil in an engine than have it low and not have oil in it. But the preferred oil is going to be what the manufacturer recommends. If they recommend a synthetic oil, that's what I would go with. They tend to be a bit more expensive, so if your manufacturer doesn't recommend it, then I would go with oil, the conventional oil they do recommend, in the interval that they recommend for it.
And let's see, we've got Tom in River Falls. He says he follows the manufacturer's recommendations for oil changes, but Toyota's guidelines say every 10,000 miles. It doesn't sound right. He's heard every 5,000 miles, and he doesn't say his vehicle.
You know, there are many vehicles that use synthetic oil, and this is Toyota's as well, do have a 10,000-mile interval. They'll say 10,000 miles or 1 year, whichever comes first. You know, and we've had a lot of discussions about oil today, and one thing I will tell you is that, you know, well, there was an earlier caller from Arena with a Hyundai Santa Fe that had a mysterious question, what happened to oil? You know, Hyundai is one company of many. Toyota is another one that have over time had various oil consumption problems. Hyundai, for example, is one that they do have some engine enhancement. They're not really recalls, but engine enhancement programs where they may help someone. So if you have a vehicle that you find has started to use oil, you want to check with the manufacturer and see if they have a special program to cover it. The other thing that's really important to remember is that it wouldn't be unusual for any vehicle, as they start to get up their miles, to use a quart of oil in a 10,000-mile interval. So a lost art, something that we don't do much anymore, most people don't do much on their own, is checking their oil. But it's something you really want to get in the habit of. If you're not going to do it yourself, I would find a shop that's happy to check it for you at some intervals in between that 10,000 miles, because if you have an engine that uses oil, in most cases, it's not going to be using so much to do damage as long as you keep track of it and add oil in between there. The big controversy when 10,000-mile oil change intervals came out that, you know, you're better off to change them at 5, so at least it's getting checked somewhere in between there. So if you're not going to check the oil at all, if you're not going to have it checked, then go with a 5,000-mile interval so that you don't, you know, as you get a higher mileage vehicle. But I would recommend learning to check the oil or have it checked so that if it does develop some minor oil consumption, you can keep ahead of it, add oil, and keep a good working engine.
One final question from a listener. Do you think idling a turbocharged engine for 30 minutes is bad for it?
It shouldn't cause damage to most vehicles, but idling and just sitting in one spot for 30 minutes can be a long time, particularly on a very hot day. I don't think it's really necessarily going to be bad for the engine. I recall one time in my career having just a very, very hot summer day in a vehicle that we needed to idle it to check something. I don't remember what it was we needed to check, but the exhaust got so hot, it was almost melting the carpet on the floorboard right above. So, I mean, there are some concerns that one may have, but just idling an engine for a half hour by itself under normal circumstances should not be a problem.
Jim, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today, and hopefully we'll get you back and we'll do it again. Thank you, Jim.
Sounds good. You're welcome, Larry.
Jim Ward has worked in the industry for over 36 years, and he does a great job describing and solving problems for us with our autos. Coming up, we're going to take a look at video games and what's going on at UW-Stout. They got a really cool program going. I'm Larry Mueller. Video games today look a lot different than they did 40 years ago. What started as Pac-Man and Tetris are now games with beautiful soundtracks and realistic graphics. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to be talking about video game creation and hear about how students at the University of Wisconsin-Stout are building their own from scratch. And Carl Cayley is with us. He's an assistant professor of game design at UW-Stout. He teaches design courses for 2D game art, 3D modeling, and exploratory games. And I'm telling you, the students are producing some great designs and great games. And as we talk with Carl, I want to hear from you. Let us know about your favorite video game, or maybe you're designing a video game of your own. How's it going? What questions do you have? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Carl Cayley, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
thanks for the great introduction. It's a pleasure to be here today, Larry.
You guys are doing some really cool things at UW Stout. Maybe just to begin, walk us through everything it takes to design a game.
Well, you know, we got to start at the very beginning and ask ourselves, what is the game? What's the experience? And I might even ask you and your listeners, like, what do they first think of when they think of a game? Going back to your childhood, you might have played very simple games like, you know, tag or dodgeball. And when designing these games, we have to start at the basics of what is the simple mechanic or the turn or how do you win the game? Are there any things that you think of going back to, you know, playing games as a child?
As a younger guy, I got involved with Berserk, and I got to be really good at Berserk. And I can remember being up north on a fishing trip, and a Berserk game was just put in, and there were three teenage boys that were just following, and they couldn't wait to get started on it. And they were playing it for a minute or two, and I walked over and I put my whatever quarters or whatever it was, and I said, "Oh, what's this game about?" And they said, "Well, you got to do this, you got to do that." And I said, "Oh, it doesn't sound too hard." So when I did it, I ran I don't know how many boards, and I said, "Oh, wasn't too hard at all," and walked away. So that was the highlight of my whole career of playing a video game was that, and they looked at me with their mouths open because they weren't doing so well just to begin. So that was a lot of fun.
Oh, Berserk. Now, that was the game where you moved a little paddle back and forth, kind of like Pong was on the sides, but it had the bottom, right?
Yeah.
And you would hit the ball. So that was definitely a eye-hand coordination, skills-based game. And
I got really good at it.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful.
Well,
yeah.
So, you know, you got to have rules. There's got to be, you know, there's a lot involved. The art is involved, mm-hmm. certainly. You know, I mean, what else, you know, what do your students learn?
Oh, my gosh. Well, we have, we've got a nationally ranked video game design and development program, typically in the top 20 ranked nationally, and one of the largest schools of art and design in the Midwest. And so the students who are in the game design program are typically in one of two different program tracks. The program that I teach in is the art side. And so we teach students how to make graphics, how to draw in the computer, how to make 3D models, and then how to make them move and animate. There's another program at Stout, it's computer science, that emphasizes game design. And those students are learning to program, to create algorithms and systems, and they work together. A big part of making these games, that collaboration is key. And at Stout, we are a polytechnic university where we really emphasize engaging and hands-on activities and applying this learning. And so it's possible to do a game by yourself, but oftentimes it requires a lot of different disciplines, a lot of different collaborations to make it come together.
Describe the range and quality of today's games. I mean, it's so different from when I was playing them a lot.
Well, you know, video games in the industry is huge. It's bigger than the film industry. And the businesses can range from a few people to thousands who are located across the world. And the range of styles can also vary. What I like to see is that there's some big companies that are pursuing this hyper-realistic games. And there's some other independent games who might not have the chances to put in all the extra features and splashing water and whatnot, but are able to embrace the style and really give a good emotional experience to a game without having that high fidelity.
I'm thinking, what kind of computer equipment do you need for the? I mean, if you're going to do something, you know, pretty fancy, you probably need some fancy equipment.
you can do an awful lot with just a simple computer. If you're doing high-end 3D graphics, then yeah, you might need to upgrade into, you know, video cards and processors to do that. But games can be still pretty simple. You can make card games and board games. And in fact, our students do that. When they go through the program, they start out their first year doing some introduction to art. They start to do the board game design and look at the rules. And then later they start to learn to do 2D graphics, then 3D games. And all that ends up culminating into a senior game, which is a full academic year, teams of 10, 12 students, both on the art side and on the computer science side, making a 3D game.
How many kids are in the program? Or students, I should say.
Well, the two programs, there's about 200 in the art and about 200 in the computer science side that's focused on games.
Wow, that's a lot of people involved. That's compared to other programs, I imagine that's a pretty popular program.
It is really popular. It's also really challenging because there's a lot that goes into making a game, to learn how to make 2D graphics and 3D graphics. And one of the fun things about it is it's not a linear process like film and movies are, you know, time-based. But to program and to anticipate what the player might do takes a lot of extra effort.
I would think so. And there's different kinds of games. I mean, there's, and maybe you can talk about it, there's sort of what they call, is it arcade games, and there's action. What other ones are involved?
Oh, there's so many different styles. There is the arcade games where you played with Berserk, which fundamentally was trying to get you to put more quarters in the machine, right?
Yeah. I got so good that I didn't have to put so many quarters in after a while.
Right. And some people like the narrative games that tells an interactive story where you have choices between which direction to take, which is kind of like the analog version of a choose your own adventure book. There's, you know, horror games, and there's games that focus on skills and time-based games, platformer games, which you've probably heard or played Mario.
Yeah,
Nintendo games.
Of course.
there's a whole bunch of games related to those. And there's also experimental games or serious games. Serious games would include things like training, simulations, which are kind of sometimes not considered in that game umbrella for entertainment, but are a really important part of the game design processes, simulating or job training.
Yeah, I was thinking about, I forget where I was when I... There was a game essentially to show you how difficult it is, I think, to be a helicopter pilot. So I crashed many times trying to deal with it. I suppose that's it was for training purposes that people used the game before they got in a helicopter, for sure.
Right. I'd want to play that game. That sounds like a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. And I realized that I guess I'm not sure I had the coordination for it. Of course, I was only at it for a few minutes, but it was being, so that's a game that was actually being used to, you know, give people the skills, the basic skills before they actually got in with an instructor in a helicopter.
Right.
Sports games, too. Those are other games that the video games. I played baseball and bowling and basketball and golf. I've done some golf games that I'm actually pretty well in those. But those are kind of fun games. Do the kids at Stout, the students at Stout, do they use those kinds of games or try to create them?
You know, sometimes they're trying to go beyond the simple sports games and maybe mash them up in new, unique ways. And so it might be a kart racing game, but you're in a different location. It might be that you are trying to solve different scenarios or puzzles in new and unique ways. That's one of the challenges we have in our exploratory games class, is to try to think of new controllers, perhaps, instead of just a standard joystick, but thinking of maybe a rhythm-based game or other ways to give a chance to explore new input devices or experiences.
Carl Cayley is our guest today. He's an assistant professor of game design at the UW Stout, talking with him about games. Hope you join in with your own question or comment, or maybe your own experience with a video game. Love to hear from you. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about video game design with our guest Carl Cayley, assistant professor of game design at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. Great to have him with us. And again, join in with your own questions or comments, or maybe your own experiences with a video game. Love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Carl, what do you love about helping students create these games?
Oh, my gosh. I love being able to watch their growth when students get it, that eureka moment when they're able to say, oh, I've played a game in the past, and now I understand how it works. Now I can get excited about making my own experience. There's an awful lot that we go through in the School of Art and Design for teaching game art for, you know, students who are interested in doing a little programming. They fill their minds up in the 4 years that they have in the bachelor's program. And I really enjoy seeing when they have that final showcase at the end of the semester to showcase all their work.
Yeah, that's the cool part about being a teacher, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You start with, in the courses I've taught, you start at a very basic level. And then at the end, if students think back to where they were when they started the semester, I taught a broadcast course a long time, and I'd always record their first assignment. And then I would, their last assignment was to produce, like a half-hour radio show. And I would, the last day of class, I'd mix together a little bit of each student from their first assignment that they read in front of the class to their last assignment, and They all are a little embarrassed, it feels like, when they turn red a little bit, when they hear their own voice from the first assignment, and then they listen to how they sound at the end, and it's always brings a bit of joy.
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's kind of like journaling or reflecting back on a diary, right? And helping them to see that process shows them the growth. I love that. That's a great idea.
What's the, I know, and you may have mentioned this, but I know that teaching interest of yours is exploratory games.
Mm-hmm.
What is that all about? Talk a bit more about that.
I would imagine that many of the listeners have experience with arcade games or console games like a Nintendo or a Xbox or PlayStation. And there's so many other games that will, for example, talk through an emotional experience or really focus in on a specific key or feature. When we take students to different local conferences, there's one in Madison called the MDEV Conference coming up in November. They get a chance to show off their games. They get to meet people in industry. And then we also take groups out to the Game Developers Conference, which is an international conference in San Francisco. And there's a whole group of alternate controller games. And some of those are very unique. In fact, you can probably only see them or play them in that one location, where it's maybe you interact with an umbrella to bounce the asteroids away from stars in space, or maybe you are on a teeter-totter rocking a ship, or trying to be a monster veterinarian with a giant, you know, Muppet type or puppet type character. Those are the type of things that I think are really fun. When students are in industry, there's deadlines and budgets and things, but when you're able to apply these in the classroom, they can take some serious chances to explore and discover and innovate new things.
Colleen emailed us and wants you to talk about assistive devices for so everybody could be involved in video games.
I know there's some existing assistive devices available. Microsoft has one, I believe, that is a device that has different pads and switches on it, and that allows players to interact with the devices in different ways. Some games, if they're really thinking about accessibility, they will put in different settings to allow you to map keys to different buttons or different controls. And so they're in many big games, they put in devices to even maybe change the coloring for individuals with color blindness.
So there are things available out there. The university hosts the Stout Game Expo. Tell us about that event.
Right. It is the culmination of the semester's work by our students. It's open to the public at the end of the semester. And during their first year, students do board games. The second year, they'll do like video, 2D video games, exploratory games in their third year. And that final year has their senior capstone. And there can be, you know, many different booths set up, and students get to showcase their games. And it's different each time. Sometimes you might have a VR game, or one time we had a physical game where people were playing in a space. And so that is in the Memorial Student Center, and they fill the whole place up with their tables and computers. And
what would be an example of a physical game? I mean, you know, I can remember and have done this with my daughter. There's the screen that we're dancing in the living room. Is that what you're talking about? And you try to keep up or follow the steps of the, you know, the design person on the screen?
Certainly. It could be a rhythm-based game where they're, you know, tapping different inputs. One year, the students made a physical game where they were hopping between different tiles. And there was turns they would take to, you know, you get two tiles for this turn, or you get to have... you know, I think there might even have been a ball involved as well. So those, you know, reinventions of simple, schoolyard games are sometimes really interesting.
What can you tell us about this year's standouts, let's say, or some standouts from the past few years?
Oh, my gosh. This last end of the year, our expo at the Stout Game Expo, there were 5 senior games, and many of them involved networking. So it was multiplayer games. And so they had to take the extra step to allow the computers to talk with each other across a network. One of them involved the inputs were on mobile phones, so you could play right from your phone. Other ones, you'd have to communicate through voice channels and whatnot. Every year gets bigger and better.
I should say it does. And I went to the website, and I was blown away by the games. And some of them you could download yourself if you wanted to play them. And I didn't check. I didn't download. I need to check. Is there a cost associated with that?
No, all those games I sent to you were free. They're available online on itch.io is the website that hosts them. But yeah, the students are learning these, you know, tools and steps to make the game. And every single game, we go through the process of thinking up a concept, We have to then consider the user who's going to be playing this and make simple prototypes. And then after many, many iterations, that simple, you know, box or ball turns into a character, and we do test it to make sure that it's meeting the needs of the original concept and the experience that we're designing for.
Michael emailed us, are there games that emphasize cooperation instead of competition?
Good question.
And we've been wondering if they're popular or are they in existence?
There are. Those games are often called asymmetric games, or I should say the one that I've helped students make before was an asymmetric cooperative game. And that game had one player as a human character, and another player was this giant bird. And the bird had to then swoop down, pick up the character, and then fly them across these other floating islands. And so I think, you know, cooperation is something that is sometimes challenging if you have players like an adult and a child who are very different in their skill levels, to try to work together to reach the same goal.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I like that idea a lot. What I'm wondering, where are game design students finding jobs after they graduate? You get a lot of people coming out for it, and where do they go to work?
Right. Well, we typically think of big game industries on the coasts, New York or California, but we do have a thriving game design community in Madison. And so some students find internships in local areas or find maybe a remote internship online. Students can also shift into other areas like architectural visualization. Sometimes they'll go to graphic design or training simulations. It can really vary depending on who's hiring and who has the interest in using the skills that our students are developing to apply to their engineering and design fields.
I know in Madison they've had some real successes and probably made quite a bit of money on this, but I'm wondering about how much would a person make in this kind of business?
Oh, that really varies from what market you're in, and I don't know that I would be able to give a big range on that, because from artists versus programmers versus network, they range greatly between the different salary ranges.
Yeah, depending on where you are. Well, if somebody out there is interested in designing their own video game, let's say, but they don't have a lot of experience, where do they start? Or where should they start?
Well, let me tell you about how I got into this. I had gone to school for 3D animation and film production, but it wasn't until I went to a local meetup that was a game jam. And this event was hosted by a local development group. And you would meet people, you would talk about skills and interests, and you would have then the weekend. It had 48 hours to make a game. And it's been so enjoyable that I've done 8 of these so far. And they're not big games, they're all free to play online. But that is something that I really enjoy, is to be able to take a big idea and put it into a small time frame and just say, try it. It might fail, but it might be awesome. And so if anybody's looking to do that, just start small and pick away at it. You can find a lot of things on YouTube and go for it.
And UW Stout's website, you just go to the website and check in video games and search, and that's going to pop up. Is that your work? Absolutely.
That's a bunch of our students' work. Yep.
Carl, a pleasure. Carl Cayley, Assistant Professor of Game Design at UW Stout. Go online, take a look at their games. They got some fantastic games, and they certainly amaze me. And they amaze Clara Neipert, our producer. Joel Patnod's our other producer. Our technical director today, Lee Rayburns. Jeff Robbins also does it. And our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller.